the Moth Radio Hour from PRX, and I'm Jay Allison, producer of this radio show. This time, stories about something we all have in common, one way or another, mothers. For starters, I'd like to establish my own credentials. So, Mom, what was I like as a little kid?
Very imaginative, very cute, very lively.
Does that mean like a pain in the neck?
No, you were a good baby. You were very good.
There you have it, the truth from my mom. Evidently, I also like stories.
And you like to read, and you like to be read to. Very satisfactory.
So, Mom, you know what the moth is, right?
I do indeed.
And
I love it.
How would you describe it?
Well, I would say it was certainly unusual and inventive and very personal. The people who are talking are really telling you what they feel, and they do it in a beautiful way. And they were not all tragic. Some of them were very funny and inspiring.
So let's start off with a funny and tragic and inspiring motherhood story from Ophira Eisenberg. She told it for our Moth member show in New York City at the Cooper Union. Here's Ophira.
So I never wanted to have kids. And when I was in my 30s, all my friends were sweating about having a family. And they would come and say things to me like, you know, when you see a baby, don't you just want to like grab it and then gnaw on its pudgy little thighs and inhale its forehead and then just grab it and run away? And I was like, no, like, what are you talking about? I did not understand their weird Hansel and Gretel fantasies. I just didn't get it. When I was in my 30s, I had goals, and they were to feed and clothe myself and live in New York. I had goals. I wanted to have a room, a bedroom that could have a bed in it that you could walk around all three sides of. And then, like, the big item that if I owned, I thought that would mean I made it, was I dreamed of owning a wine fridge. That was my dream. With wine in it that lasted more than one weekend. So, I'm the youngest of six kids, and growing up, my mother always said to me, never get married and never have kids. They'll ruin your life. Not exactly what you want to hear from your mother, but I, you know, what she meant was that she wanted me to be able to have a career, follow my dreams, not feel pressure to settle down, do whatever I wanted. You know, it was very much like what she wasn't able to do, and I took it to heart. Now, in my 40s, things kind of started to gel together. I had a bit of a career. I was married to a guy I loved. I traveled. You know, it felt pretty good. So I ordered a wine fridge. And then the next second, just a sledgehammer went through the whole thing. After a routine mammogram, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, early stage breast cancer, but as you know, there's no such thing as lucky cancer. And I fell apart. Thus started a year of hell. And I did not respond to it by having a Tig Notaro moment and spin the whole thing into comedy gold. I was destroyed. I fell apart. I dragged myself from one surgery and then another surgery, appointments and tests, and then 30 days of radiation. I completely lost sense of myself. I didn't relate to who I was in the past. I didn't even know if I could think of who I was in the future. And you know, there's this little bit of wisdom people say all the time, you know, that you should live in the moment. Let me tell you something. There is nothing worse than being forced to live in the moment. Thinking about the future, like just musing on what could happen next, that is for the happy and the carefree. So at the end of that year, I went to go back to the doctor, and of course, they don't really use the word remission anymore, but he said, you know, you responded well to all the treatments, and things look really good, so, you know, have a good time, and we'll see you in another year, and we'll start testing again. And I tried to ease myself back into my old life or figure out what my new life was. And before I could really even get it together, I got pregnant. Like by accident. From my husband. It was unbelievable, mostly because I honestly didn't think my body was capable of ever doing anything that beautiful. Again, I didn't think that I was ever going to be able to, it would ever just do anything normal. I mean, it was like looking out onto a cracked, barren soil field and seeing just a little tiny green shoot. And, you know, and I have to admit, I didn't think so much about gnawing on pudgy thighs. I was just so elated that maybe this meant I was supposed to survive. Could I get excited? Should I be concerned? Before I could even pick one, I miscarried. I hate saying that word. I know you hate hearing it. It's so common, though, it makes me think we should talk about it more. But I got a call from my OBGYN saying that the miscarriage was something called a partial molar pregnancy. That is, it's just a genetic mistake. It's not based on age or prior health history or nothing. Bad luck, as she said. It's what was growing in me wasn't so much a fetus, but a regular group of cells. And what is an irregular group of cells considered? Cancer. My own pregnancy had given me another cancer scare. And to make sure that it didn't develop into cancer, I needed to go get tested every week by giving blood for 6 months. I couldn't believe it. I felt like I was never going to be able to move forward. You know, I was depressed. That is an understatement. I wasn't suicidal. That wasn't enough. I didn't want to destroy myself. I wanted to destroy everything. I wanted to rip up the sky and light everything on fire and watch it all burn to the ground. It was a very dark time. I'm pretty sure it was summer. Now, somehow at the end of that, you know, 6 months has passed. I'm back in my OBGYN's office. My husband, Jonathan, is with me. And she delivers the great news, like, guess what? It's great. You're cleared. You're good to go. And then she says, so you guys can try again. And we are just sitting in silence, shocked silence. So much so that she goes, well, don't you want to have kids again? So interesting. First of all, we never tried to begin with. Second of all, we were just trying to get to a place where I just felt normal and in control of my body again. And man, I've been asked, do I want to have kids, thousands of times in my life. And I usually just responded with a bit of a joke, to be honest. I would say, sure I do, but who's going to raise them? Or, you know, yes, of course, but I live in New York. Where am I going to put them? But this time I just looked at her right in her eyes and I said, it's too late. I'm too old. And she reminded me that she had many patients of an advanced maternal age. And she suggested that I go get an egg count test, a blood test. And she ended the appointment with saying, why don't we just see what happens? Now, if anything seemed routine and normal to me, it was giving blood. So I went into Quest Diagnostics, one of the most casual medical facilities on the planet. I mean, it's hard to believe that that exists. You walk in and, like, there's a woman faxing forms, and you say, hey, I'm here to give some blood, and she puts down the toner and snaps on gloves. You're like, you know, she fishes out a syringe from a pencil case, and there's no diplomas on the walls. There's There's just lockup instructions. But she took my blood, and then a few days later I got an email from my OBGYN with a weird number and just a one-line note. And it just said, an encouraging number for someone your age. And I cried, because it was the nicest thing anyone in the medical community had said to me for years. And I looked at the calendar and I thought, maybe I'll see if Jonathan wants to try. I told him about the results of the test over breakfast. I said, oh, you know, the omelet you made me reminded me that... You know, when I was like, encouraging number, my age, encouraging eggs. And Jonathan nodded, and he looked very pensive, and he said, you know, he said, while I can imagine us having a life with kids, you know, I can also imagine us not having a life with kids, and we'd be okay together, you know, we'd travel, and we'd do nice things, we'd have a nice life, just the two of us as well. And I know he was being honest, but I also really felt he was trying to protect me. I mean, he didn't want me going through anything more. He didn't want me to be put in another medical situation or something, another physical thing happened to me. And I got it. I was equally terrified. I wanted nothing more to just feel like nothing could ever get to me again. But later that day, weirdly, I found myself writing him an email. My own husband, I wrote him an email. And I just wrote, I think we should try, because we can't guarantee that we're going to have a kid. We can just try and see what happens. But if we don't try just because we're scared, then the fear has won, and I can't live in that world. And he responded, great, let's do it. So I will admit, though, month one, when I got my period, I wasn't all like, we can't guarantee it, we'll just try and see what happens. I swore at my period. I swore at my body. I was like, what's going on, encouraging eggs? Like, I was so mad. And I felt this primal urge in me that I was like, I have to have a baby, and it has to happen now. And then the second month, when I didn't get my period, I was just silently terrified. Now, all through all of this, people kept telling me, through all of it, they said, you need to think positively. And I would just go, what are you talking about? How can I look at myself in the mirror and lie to myself? Because I know what it's like when things don't work out the way you want them to. But now I kind of understand what that's about. Because it really doesn't matter if you think positive or negative. It has zero influence on the outcome. But it certainly changes how you experience the moment. I'm lucky. I have a one-year-old baby boy at home right now. His name is Lucas. His crib is taking over the room that was supposed to be my dream office, and he's learning how to walk, and he's always tripping over the wine fridge. And he's sweet. You know, he smiles all the time for no reason. And I'm still full of fear. Oh my God, so many question marks loom in the future. But I try to challenge myself. I try to say, okay, if everything fell apart, if everything went to hell the worst way possible, would I think to myself, I am so glad I did not let myself experience joy or happiness in the moment, because it really protected me from the future. No, life doesn't work like that. So now my goal is sort of like that joke about ruining my life. That my mom said to me, my goal is that me, Jonathan, and Lucas that we all get to ruin our lives together. Thank you.
Ophira Eisenberg is a comedian, writer, and host of NPR's trivia show, Ask Me Another. Ophira's debut memoir, Screw Everyone, Sleeping My Way to Monogamy, has been optioned for a feature film. The day after Ophira told this story, she went back for her yearly mammogram and checkup, and all was normal. She was told she was part of the survivorship program. She said she cried so hard they asked her if she understood that it was good news.
This Mother's Day, what is going to happen? You know, it's all so new. I am not going to expect anything. I feel like, honestly, if Mother's Day means that we just can go out for a walk or something, I am so low-key. I'd never want my child to do to me what I did to my mother, which was make her breakfast in bed of some just terrible, like, terrible half-raw scrambled eggs and some not toasted toast that the orange juice has fallen onto, so it's a little soggy, and then you just sit there with wide eyes and make her eat it by staring at her and, you know, cold coffee. Please, Lucas, you do not have to do that. It's going to be just fine. At the end of Mother's Day, if I can crack open a nice $8 Merlot from the wine fridge and cheers that, you know, another day that we made it through all together, that is the best I can hope for.
If for any reason you might want to, you can see a photograph of Ophira's wine cooler with a baby lock on it at themoth.org. In a moment, more true stories for this Mother's edition of the Moth Radio Hour, which is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX. You're listening to the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jay Allison, and this episode is about mothers. Can you imagine telling a moth story, Mom?
No.
You sure?
I'm sure.
Because you're afraid of talking in front of groups, or because you wouldn't want to get that personal?
Oh, afraid of talking in front of groups. My knees knocking would be heard across the room. And I think they're brave to get up there and tell them.
I do, too.
Yeah.
Our next brave storyteller is Terry Wolfish Cole at a Grand Slam in New York City, where we partner with public radio station WNYC.
So when I was little, my dad worked late a really lot, and my mom was left to deal with two small kids. There was me and there was my sister Lisa, who was not quite 2 years younger than I was. And my mom, on all these evenings, would feed us dinner and give us a bath together and put us both to bed, and that was the end of that. And one day, one hot summer day, when I was about 5 years old, I was playing with the kids next door, and I found out that in other people's houses, older kids had later bedtimes. And this, I was like, what even? So I go home to my mother with my newfound information, and I advocate for policy change. And I am denied. And this is it. I've had it. This big sister thing is not what it's cracked up to be. Every time we both do something together that we're not supposed to do, I get in more trouble. everybody's always paying attention to her. She's little, she's cute, she's got that eye patch thing going on. And I'm done. And we have to go to bed at the same time. I've had it. So I go to my room, and from my closet, I take my white vinyl Partridge Family sleepover suitcase, and I put it on the bed, and I start to pack. Now, I'm an early reader, so into the suitcase goes Nancy Drew and Amelia Bedelia and some Barbies, and by the time I'm done, there is no room left for clothes. But I'm leaving forever, and I'm running away, so I know I'm going to need a wardrobe. And I put on a pair of pants, two pair of underwear first, because you got to have a change, right? A pair of pants, a pair of shorts, a t-shirt, a hoodie, a raincoat, and over it all, a crocheted poncho with fringes. And I go down the stairs where my mother is in the kitchen, and she kind of looks up, and she asks if I'm running away, and I tell her yes. And she is not nearly as upset by this as I feel she should be. And she looks at me and she goes, are you going to Grandma Sylvia's? Which is the only other place I know how to be because it's not even a mile away, but I can't believe she can figure this out. She's like some kind of witch. And I don't answer her and I leave. And I go out the front door and down the driveway. Now remember, it's the 70s and they have not yet invented suitcases with wheels and mine is full of books. So with every step, I'm dragging my suitcase. And I go down the driveway, left on Redwood, left on Clearfield, left on Red Oak, and I, with every step, I am sweating and dragging and sweating and dragging. And I am so intent on my mission that I don't realize my mother is like 20 yards behind in her Plymouth Fury following and waving concerned citizens on their way. And finally, it's the left on Old Lyme, and I get to number 73, Grandma's apartment building. And I go up the stairs to the building, and before I even knock, the door opens, and my grandma tells me she's very happy to see me, but I'm certainly not living there forever. And I realize my mother has called ahead, and I have been betrayed. So I'm in the living room. My grandma, she's like, do you want a drink as long as you're here? So she goes to get me some juice. And I'm in the living room, and I'm taking off my layers, and my mother comes sweeping in. And she sits down in my grandfather's wingback chair, and she pats her lap. She goes, come here. And I don't want to go because I am righteously pissed. But I'm hot, and I'm five, and I get on my mother's lap. And she pushes my hair back behind my ear, and she says, sweetheart, what is it? Why have you left? Why have you run away? And it all comes tumbling out. It's not fair, and all the time, and Lisa, I get into trouble, and she doesn't, and we should not have the same bedtime. And my mother, who has always known me better than I've known myself, takes my hot, red little face in her hands, and she says to me, sweetheart, I don't want you to be so miserable. She says, you came first. If it's that hard for you living with Lisa in the house, tomorrow morning I will call the orphanage and we will send her away. I said, okay. And I realize I know what orphans are. I read. I know what the orphanage is. And I start to cry, and I beg her, don't send my sister away. No, no, no. And my mother reluctantly agrees that we'll all go home, and we'll give it another try. And that night, my mother feeds us scrambled eggs and SpaghettiOs for dinner. And she gives us a bath, and she puts us to bed at the same time as she will for many years to come. And in those years to come, Lisa and I will grow to be two halves of the same whole. We will be there through adventures and concerts and boyfriends and divorces and death and everything. But every once in a while, we'll have a fight. And if that happens, to this day, and I turn over my shoulder and I say, "Mom, Lisa's being mean to me." My mother always answers in the same way, and she says, "You had your chance." Thank you.
Perry Wolfish Cole stepped onto the storytelling stage for the first time last year, and since then, she's won several competitions. She's also the founder of Tell Me Another, a new show in the Hartford, Connecticut area that encourages ordinary people like her to share their extraordinary stories. So you're pushing 90, Mom.
Yes.
Do you still, would you say you think about your mother every day?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
A lot of you have left messages about your mothers on our pitch line at themoth.org. We have a few minutes to hear one now, and I'll give you more information about contacting us with your story ideas after this one from Jane Gideon.
So I wanted to tell you a story about my mother. Now, my mother did not like change. She had never even really accepted that Hawaii was part of the United States, for example. She lived in the same house in the same small town for over 40 years. And nothing much really happened there until one day our next door neighbors both passed away and they sold the house. So we got new neighbors. And my mom had been trying to meet them but hadn't had any luck. But one day she met the lady of the house of the new neighbors next door in the most shocking way. So my mom was taking out the trash and she uses a walker. So it was a very slow process when she hears this rustling in the yard next door and she turns to see this woman coming at her in a full-on black burqa. Now, my mom is terrified, and she grabs her walker and tries to scurry and run back into the house because she's never seen anything like this. Of course, the woman was just coming to help her take the trash to the curb, but my mom was on high terrorist alert and called me to come, you know, help sort out how she's going to deal with the Al-Qaeda neighbors next door. Now, of course, keep in mind that my mom was not a fan of Obama. This was confirmation that Obama had let in the Muslims, and of course he had because he was from Hawaii. So anyway, while she and I are talking, the woman next door comes over and knocks on the door. Now, my mom was nervous about talking to her again, but, you know, she seemed nice enough. So my mom opened the door, and it turns out the woman asked her to help her learn to speak English. She was from Syria, and she just moved here, and she didn't know anybody and didn't know how to speak the language. So she asked my mom to help. Now, my mom had only had a seventh grade education, and she was very sensitive about this. So this woman asking her to teach her English made my mom so proud she just couldn't refuse. So over the years, they began spending more and more time together as my mom taught this woman how to speak English with a hillbilly accent, I might say. But eventually, they became really good friends. And when my mom passed away, I had to go over and tell the woman next door that my mother had died. And when I did, she collapsed on her couch and started sobbing and said, "She was my best friend. I loved your mom." So my mom, who had avoided change her whole life, finally embraced the foreign neighbor next door in the last years of her life, and in the process, gained a best friend.
Remember, you can leave a short message telling us a short version of your story about mothers or anything else at themoth.org. Our next storyteller is Andy Christie from another Story Slam where we partnered with WNYC in New York. Here's Andy.
So a few months ago, I guess in October, I'm down in Florida, Boynton Beach, at my mother's one-bedroom little condo apartment she has down there. For the last 12, 13, 14 years, I've been going down there three or four times a year to, visit and, fix her toilet plunger and, rehang her cabinet doors, be a son, tell the neighbor to turn down the TV once in a while I'm down there. And I'm down there for the last 6 or 7 years. One of those visits was always, I would always get there a little bit early, and I would spend a few days first being there alone, setting up the apartment to make it nice for her when she got back from the hospital, because she would spend a couple of days in the hospital kind of having her essential systems kind of tuned up. And she'd come back home as good as new. or as good as sort of a used but well-maintained, you know, machine. She wound up down there after a pair of not wildly successful marriages that began with my father. They met at the end of World War II in occupied Austria. He was a 5'6" private who worked in the Scottish private who worked in the mess hall. She was a 5'9" Yugoslavian farm girl, a refugee. They got married, had a couple of kids, of which I was one, moved to America and got divorced. So quickly, it was almost like they moved to America to get divorced. And I always figured it was kind of like once the Nazis were out of the picture, they had time to, you know, finally had time to take a good look at each other. But they're just different. They're just different. The kind of the shorthand is she was kind of easily pleased. He was like easily satisfied. You know, it's a subtle distinction. Unless you are both variables in that equation there. Dad was always kind of like, yeah, that's good enough. And Mom was always kind of like, oh, that's good. That's good. You know, you're not setting fire to my ancestral home. Thank you. You're not raping me. That's good. That's good. You know, the war-torn experience leaves a mark on you. And, you know, like, I enjoyed that. She used the word enjoy a lot. You know, we all say, well, like, you know, do you enjoy your dinner? She would say, I enjoy my dinner. But she used it in a way that was sometimes not just, like, perfectly on the button, you know. Like, she would say she enjoyed her gravy or something. Because I think she had never lost a little bit of shame about not being American, about not being so kind of fluent in language, about being a farm girl, being uneducated. And I think she thought the word enjoy was just a little fancier. And a couple of pages further along in the Slavic American, you know, translation dictionary, she enjoyed things. So I'm down there this particular time, and I am setting up the place, and it's one of the times when she is away at the hospital. Only this time it's a little bit different because I find out after I get there, after I've been there for a couple of days, that she is not doing as well as she usually does at the hospital. That she has, when the doctor says, she turned a corner. And I am setting up the apartment to kind of welcome her back home. Only now she is not just coming back home, but she's coming to back home hospice. So I have spent the last couple of days getting rid of her bed and replacing it with a hospital bed and taking all of this stuff that has erupted out of boxes. Like I say, she had never left behind her kind of European, Austrian, Slavic background. All the stuff that I spent my entire youth telling her that really it's not a very American thing. You know, you really got to put that stuff away. All those sort of like little kind of like tatted doilies that you get from your nieces. They're a little embarrassing to me. They're not American. We're more hard-edged, you know? And but when she moved down there and she finally had her life all by herself, she kind of, these things kind of bubbled up out of these cardboard boxes that we had forced her to store away. And I am now kind of, I had to get rid of her bed, and I am pushing all of this stuff, all these artifacts from her background, from her youth, into the perimeter of the room and putting a hospital bed in the middle of it. And it's not flowery and it's not soft. It's very hard-edged and very modern and very kind of high-tech. It's kind of as if you had, if you took the roof off of your dollhouse and you found like a switchblade sitting in the middle of the vanity, you know, and all these things that I also found sort of embarrassing and a little mortifying has suddenly become a little bit sort of sad and beautiful. And she had sort of turned this little one-bedroom apartment back into the old country. And now there's a hospital bed in the middle of it, and she is in it, and I'm outside on the landing smoking a cigarette. And she's not spoken. She hasn't eaten for a couple of days. She's in hospice. They're just kind of letting her go away. I'm not by myself. There's a nurse, a private duty nurse, and there is a health aide in there with her. I'm smoking out there, remembering that maybe she, even in this state, she knows that I'm smoking because she could even tell that I was exhaling smoke and not air when I talked to her from New York, you know, between New York to Florida somehow. And I'm out there, and this girl walks down the landing, and she has a guitar strapped to her back and a shoulder bag, and she says she is the hospice music therapist and would I like her to sing some songs for my mother. And I think, really? Really? Like this, like, kind of like, you know, retro hippie is going to, what are you going to sing? Like, you know, Send in the Clowns for my mother, who's like, music wasn't a big part of our lives anyway. But, you know, what am I going to do? I said, okay, let's go in. And I go in, and she sits down, my brother and I are in there, and she says, so what kind of music did you like? Music, again, was not a big part of our lives. I wanted to be a rock musician, of course. My brother wanted to be a drummer, and so my mother got him accordion lessons. I say, I don't know. Not, you know, do you know any polkas? She says, I don't know, does she like show tunes? And I said, I don't know. She said, what about The Sound of Music? And Artie and I, my brother, both looked at each other. Sound of Music was the only VHS tape we had growing up. And after every Thanksgiving, after every Christmas, after every Easter, we went into the family room, we watched The Sound of Music. It was about Austria, it was about my mother's homeland. And I said, yes, The Sound of Music. And so this girl brought her guitar, and she started playing, and in the most just unbelievably angelic voice. And the sound, she played Edelweiss. And Edelweiss is the kind of song that you could easily make fun of until you hear it again. It's kind of like, you know, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It's an unbelievably beautiful song. And she sang it to my mother and us, the four of us in the room, and my mother, again, who had not spoken, had not eaten, had not making, not recognized anybody for a few days, listened to it and with us, and there was not a dry eye in the room when we left. One of the nurse's aides had to leave. She was sobbing. I was crying, of course. My brother was crying. And when it was over, and there's that kind of, you know, the sort of instinct you have when any performance, I don't care if it's at a funeral or whatever, you clap when someone finishes. And we all clapped, and my mother, who hadn't moved a muscle for a couple of days, raised her arms to clap. And I kind of leaned over, rubbed her head, and I said, did you like that? And she said, after not having spoken for a couple of days, said, I enjoyed it. And the next morning, she was gone, and those were her last words. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Andy Christie is the creative director of Slim Films, an animation and illustration studio. His stories have appeared in the New York Times and The Moth Anthology, and he's creator and host of The Liar Show, a live storytelling series. To see lots of photos of Andy and his mom, visit themoth.org. And right now you're listening to a recording Andy made of the hospice music therapist in his mother's room. Coming up, our final story for our Moth Mothers show in just a moment. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX. You're listening to the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jay Allison, and in this show, we have stories by and about mothers.
If you did get up and tell a moth story, Mom, what do you think it might be about?
I really wouldn't. My life has been so simple that I can't really think.
That's not true. Nobody's life is simple.
Well, but given the ordinary vicissitudes, you know, I suppose if I spoke of anything, I'd probably speak of how lucky I feel to be to have been adopted and have the parents that I had. We're so accepting in a time that adoption was not done. And my mother with a germ complex, how on earth she took a 9-day-old baby in.
We will leave my mother's stories for another time, if my mother can be persuaded to tell them publicly, which I doubt. Here, then, is our final story, told at a showcase in New York City as part of the Moth's community program. It's told by Samuel Lewis Lee.
It's 1964, so I'm a 14-year-old kid going to visit his mother in the hospital. Mother was in the hospital, she had cancer. She had been in the hospital since I was 10. So going to see her in the hospital was kind of the highlight of my day. So this particular day I go to see her in the hospital, and I play this game where I kind of avoid the hospital staffs, and I sneak up the stairs, and when I come out the stairway, her room is right across the hall. So on this particular day I come out the stairway, and I notice that her bed is empty. So my thing is, I asked the nurse, well, where's my mother? You know, so the nurse said she was gone. So my response was, gone where? Going to another floor? Going for x-rays? So the dietitian pulled me to the side, and he says that your mother died, that you should go home and talk to your family. He didn't know that, you know, my home was like my father was a violent alcoholic, and my family was my friends. You know, so I tried to make my way home. You know, I had tears in my eyes and I was crying. And I find myself in front of a bus that's screeching, stopping. You know, so I just walk in front of this bus to try to get home. And the bus driver had to stop short, and he got out the bus to curse me out. So then when he figured out that something was wrong with me, he asked me what was wrong. So I told him I just found out that my mother died. So he put his hand on my shoulder, put me in the front of the bus, and told me everything was going to be all right. So he made sure I got home. So after the funeral, you know, I'm hanging out on a stoop, and this lady comes up to me, and she introduces herself. She says, my name is Rose. You know, I know who you are, and I owe your mother a favor, because she got the NAACP to stop an eviction process. She says, I want you to come by my house, you know, and hang out. So she asked me, was I hungry? So she bought me a sandwich and a soda and some cookies and took me to her stoop, which she lived at. So she said, I want you to come by here every day if I can look out for you. So I would come by every day after school, but it didn't take me long to figure out that Rose was a prostitute. Right. So, you know, and she says, you know, I'm going to look out for you. You know, I want you to come by. I'm going to take care of you. So after my mother died, I kind of started messing up in school. So Rose says, well, I'm going to take you to school and talk to your guidance counselor and see what the problem is. So she says, I want you to meet me on the stoop tomorrow at 8 o'clock, and we're going to go to your school. So the next day, I'm sitting on her stoop, and this lady comes by with this big flowery dress on, and this nice hat and this pocketbook that was like really, you know, like going to church. I didn't recognize her. So she turns around and says, come on, Junior, I don't have all day. So when I noticed it was Rose, I was saying she looked distinctly different than when she's going to the school than when she's working, you know. So she takes me to the school, and she's not really able to do anything because she's not my biological mother. She doesn't have the paperwork. So we come back to the house. So she sits me on the stoop. She says, well, just stay out on the stoop for a minute. I'm going to go in the house and change. So she goes in the house and she changes. She comes out, sits on the stoop with me. And she says, well, listen, you got to find a job. I got to get you a job. So I said, okay. So she got me a job with some of her best tricks, some of her best customers. So one job was sweeping up in Nathan's on 42nd Street at night. You know, another job was kind of sweeping up in the pool room, but the most memorable job that she got me was working in a shooting gallery. So a shooting gallery, for the visuals, is a two-room apartment with anywhere from 5 to 30 people in there, young, old, black, white, Spanish, Asian, a very diverse crowd. you know, and they are in there to shoot dope or coke or both. Shooting gallery is definitely an equal opportunity destination, you know. And so, and my job was to clean the coffee cans out, change the water from the bloody water to the clear water. That was my job. So one day on the job, you can call it that, so I hear a lot of commotion, you know, and these two drug addicts are fighting each other. And one drug addict gets thrown out the window. And so I'm a little kid, you know, so I back up, I stay out the way. And the guy who ran the gallery, his name was Red, you know, light-skinned guy with red hair. So he says, you know, do you know what just happened? And I said, no, I don't know, you know. He said, well, one dope fiend stole a piece of cotton from another dope fiend, and you just can't do that in here. So he asked me, did I learn anything? I said, sure, I learned that you thou shalt not steal. You know, so that was the lesson I learned from that incident. So then, you know, so I started hanging out with Rose, and I started working at the shooting gallery. So I started the job when I was 14. So I worked there until I was 17. So when I became 17, Rose says, okay, you know enough. You kind of go on your own and just do your own thing. So as a result of working in the shooting gallery and being raised by a prostitute, my natural vehicle of economic development was selling drugs. So I sold drugs for a few years. I sold drugs for about 5 years. I had a good run, you know, apartment, cars, and all that stuff. But 5 years later, I find myself in jail under the Rockefeller law. So I find myself in jail for selling drugs. They have pictures of me selling drugs to an undercover cop in my pajamas in front of my house. And my thing was, I wasn't going to cop to it. You know, so, and at that time, we had a governor by the name of Nelson Rockefeller. And so this was the first year that he implemented the Rockefeller law. So that means I was guaranteed to do 20 years. So when I went in front of the judge says, look, you're going to cop out to 20 years and you start. So my thing was, I wasn't going to cop out to it. So I kind of hung out for 2 months before I decided I might as well take this plea and start to do this bid. So as I am in my cell, you know, I just figured, you know, everybody in jail knows God, right? So I'm praying. And so I got my hands on the bar, and I'm not praying for me so much. I'm praying for other little kids that come out the community who didn't have no parents, wouldn't wind up like me. So I'm holding the bars and I'm praying, and when I open my eyes and I look down, I see a pair of cowboy boots outside my cell. And I look up, and it's this white boy with a collar, you know. So he says, well, I apologize. I didn't want to bother you while you was praying. He said, a friend asked me to come and check on you and see how you're doing. So I said, well, who was that? He said, well, Rose. He said, do you remember a lady named Rose? I said, of course I remember Rose. How is she doing? He said, well, she's dying, and on her deathbed, she asked me to come and check on you. I checked on the judge. You know, you got a real rough judge. He's a real racist guy. He's going to give you the maximum, 20, 25 years. But I will be in court the next day with you because somebody should be in court with you. So the next day I go to court, the judge, the presiding judge, is not there. So they have a substitute judge sitting on the bench. And he can't figure out why I'm there. The DA doesn't have my records. So he's mad at the DA, like, why has this guy been here for 2 months and he hasn't been sentenced and he hasn't started no jail time anywhere? So he asked me, well, why was I in jail? So I thought about it for a minute, and I wasn't going to tell him I was in jail for selling drugs. You know, so I told him I was at the wrong place at the wrong time. So what happens is that he looked out into the courtroom and he says, is anybody here for Mr. Lee? So the white guy got up with the collar and says, well, I talked to Mr. Lee, and now I'll be responsible for him if you release him. So the judge released me to this guy. So I come to find out that the guy he released me to was Father Pitt, the founder of Samaritan Halfway Society. And so the moral of the story is that from the day that my mother died, who was my protector, to the day where my other protector, my other mother, was dying from her deathbed, sent this guy to kind of save me, is that there's nothing stronger than a mother's love. And I will hope that they are sitting upstairs side by side looking down and are proud of what I've become. Thank you.
That was Samuel Lewis Lee. He told his story as part of the Moths Community Program in 2016. These days, Samuel is a digital media consultant and produces short-form documentaries through his company, Encounters in Black Traditions. Those who know Samuel describe him as, quote, a touchable example of resilience.
You know, I know my story is a non-traditional story. You know, I know my story is probably a little different than other people's stories, you know, because my life experience has been distinctly different, you know. But I would just hope that, sharing my story, you know, it was therapeutic for me, you know, because I never really shared the entire story, you know, until I had the opportunity to do it through the showcase. You know, so it was therapeutic for me.
To see photos and hear more of that interview with Samuel Lewis Lee, visit themoth.org.
Do you think it's important to listen to the stories of other people?
Absolutely.
Why?
It's good for anybody to hear of somebody else's point of view and problems, particularly if you've led a sheltered life like mine. You should be aware of that and sympathetic to it.
I want to thank my mother, Barbara Allison, for pitching in on this hour about mothers, and we'll put up a little story or two she told us about her mother on our website. That's it for this episode. We hope you'll join us next time, and that's the story from The Moth. Maggie Sino and Janelle Pfeiffer directed some of the stories in this show, and the rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, Jennifer Hickson, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Timothy Lou Lee. Moth stories are true, as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Bill Frizzell, Jan Johansson, Penguin Cafe Orchestra, Ramzi Adbioridwan, and the Black Keys. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the National Endowment for the Arts. It was presented by PRX. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching your own story and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.